the nation's capital. This is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes, back after a three-month hiatus due to flipping a motorcycle and being injured. And we're finally back to doing weekly radio programs. For those of you who have been kind enough to inquire where you've been, Len, well, that's where I've been. I've been laid up telecommuting and away from the microphones. But we do have a really interesting show today, ladies and gentlemen, on pretrial. The whole concept is measuring what pretrial does. And so pretrial agencies, both in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country, can do a better job of pretrial supervision. We have two experts with us today. Spurgeon Kennedy, he is the Director of Research, Analysis, and Development of the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia, www.dcpsa.gov. I'll be giving those website addresses throughout the program. Lori Evel, the Correctional Program Specialist for the National Institute of Corrections. The National Institute of Corrections is part of the Bureau of Prisons, U.S. Department of Justice, www.nicic.gov. And to Spurgeon and to Laurie, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Thank you, Len.
Yes, thanks for having us.
And welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. Spurgeon, the first question is going to go to you. There's a lot of people out there in the criminal justice system who listen to this program on a regular basis, and they're going to know exactly what pretrial is, and they're going to know exactly what jails are. But there are people from mayor's offices or citizens or community organizations that listen to this program, and they're not quite sure what we mean by pretrial. What is pretrial supervision?
Well, simple answer is that pretrial services agencies help their local jurisdictions meet the requirements of their state bail laws. Most bail laws across the country have a presumption of release for most defendants, except those charged with capital offenses and very serious crimes. Pretrial agencies across the country help assess the various levels of risk that these defendants present and offer appropriate release supervision conditions that meet those risk levels.
Now, you do know, because I've been to community meetings, you've been to community meetings throughout our career. You go into community meetings and somebody says, he got arrested and he was back on the street in 6 hours. And that's wrong. You know, he did a crime and he's back in the community. What gives with that? And the point in all of this, is it not, that people who are arrested are considered innocent until proven guilty, until a judge or jury finds them guilty and sentence has been pronounced. So up until that point, technically, that person is a quote-unquote innocent person. And somebody's got to make an assessment based upon two things: whether or not he or she is going to return the trial on their own with supervision or with bail or with some other arrangement, or B, their risk to public safety. So do I have – is that summation correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a huge difference between a convicted defendant and a pretrial defendant. And what we deal with on the pretrial level are those persons who are still considered to be innocent or presumed innocent until that point of disposition. What we found over the last decade, especially when you look at the risk of defendants who are released back into the community, and certainly that's a legitimate concern. Public safety is always a concern for anybody in the criminal justice business. But what we have found is that defendants, by and large, who are released pretrial, present a low to medium level of risk of failure to appear or to commit another offense while on supervision. So by identifying this risk and offering supervision levels, pretrial agencies across the country actually help their jurisdictions manage that risk and to make sure that defendants who are released are not presenting an overly concern of public safety.
And the last question before going over to Laurie is the sense that people need to understand, I think, that it is literally mathematically impossible. There are tens of millions of arrests in the United States every year. There aren't tens of millions of jail beds. So
yeah.
Even if we didn't have a presumption of innocence, even if we didn't have a presumption of release on a pretrial basis, it is mathematically impossible to keep all people arrested behind bars until trial, correct?
Absolutely right. In 2010, the National Center for State Courts estimated that there were 21 million filings of felony and misdemeanor cases across the country and local courts. Our jail population cannot support that.
Oh, no.
And the risk that, again, that most pretrial defendants present and the laws that we live under really don't allow us to consider jail first. So, again, we need a system that identifies those defendants appropriate for release according to the law and those who should be detained pretrial. And that really is the basis of what pretrial programs
do. And the final thing I did want to mention in terms of the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia, one of the things that I noticed years ago was that you have an 88% return rate. The overwhelming majority of the people on your caseload show up for trial.
True.
And it's a much higher return rate than the national average. Average as measured by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So, first of all, congratulations on doing a very good job. Laurie Evel, Correctional Program Specialist for the National Institute of Corrections. What is the National Institute of Corrections, Laurie?
Well, the National Institute of Corrections, as you said, is within the Department of Justice, and its primary function is to provide support to federal, state, and local correctional agencies throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We do that through technical assistance, through education, an information center in which people can go to a vast library to get information that's particular to issues that they're dealing with. And NIC is also a leader in developing policy and practices and looking sort of a step ahead of mm-hmm. where corrections agencies and criminal justice agencies need to move or are moving and give them support. And it's really one of the primary purposes why NIC is interested in pretrial services
mm-hmm.
because it is a distinct function within a criminal justice system, but it is an essential contributor to the efficiency of a criminal justice system, as you said, not a fiscal efficiency, but as well as a case processing efficiency.
Well, we do have to talk about the fiscal part of it because the principal subject of my reading criminal justice literature, newspaper articles, radio reports, television reports over the last 2 years is the fiscal, dire fiscal shape that states mm-hmm. and localities find themselves in. So, you know, you just can't lock up everybody. It is mathematically impossible. It is fiscally impossible to lock up everybody. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you did in terms of this report, and report is measuring what matters from the National Institute of Corrections, outcomes and performance measures for the pretrial services field. What you're trying to do is to frame this whole concept of pretrial to get everybody to measure what it is they're doing so they can figure out how they're doing and how they can improve.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's also distinguishing pretrial outcomes and measures from other criminal justice functions, such as probation,
mm-hmm.
Jails, and we don't have a document like this.
Mm-hmm.
We have these established measures for other criminal justice functions, but we don't in pretrial. And as front end of the system functions are becoming more evident in their need, that's why we sought to develop a consistent set of recommended outcomes and measures, along with the definitions, so we can get to comparing different jurisdictional functionings,
mm-hmm.
looking at national averages,
mm-hmm.
and then also focusing on those things that pretrial services should produce, and that is appearance rates. That's what a primary function of a pretrial services should be, is that they have good appearance rights to court and that they have good public safety rights.
Okay, getting them to court, that's the bottom line in protecting public safety.
That's the bottom line of pretrial.
Before you go on, I do want to mention the National Institute of Corrections is the place where the rest of us go to get information.
Yes.
I mean, that's I've been involved in the criminal justice system for 42 years, been doing public relations for 30, been doing corrections for 20, and it was interesting that when I first became a public affairs officer for a large agency in the state of Maryland that had corrections as well as law enforcement, as well as the fire marshal's office, as well as lots of other agencies, I realized that I didn't have any formal training as a public affairs director. And the first thing NIC did was to put me in Boulder, Colorado for a couple weeks of training. All throughout my career, when we said we needed research or we needed funding or we needed to look at this issue, we picked up the phone and called the National Institute of Corrections. So I want to thank you in terms of my own experience and my own criminal justice career. I'm not quite sure if a lot of people know the National Institute of Corrections, www.nicic.gov, but a personal thank you to NIC for all the help that you've given me and the agencies that I've represented throughout my career. Okay, so we're going to get back to larger issues in terms of measuring what matters. The average person is going to sit back and he's going to listen to this program or she's going to listen to this program, and they're going to say, what are we talking? This is 2011. I thought you guys were doing this for decades. Mm-hmm. We in the criminal justice system, Spurgeon, don't do a very good job of measuring things, do we? I mean, most of the criminal justice agencies have a hard time coming to grips with measurement, correct?
It is, and unless you're a nerd like me, talking about numbers and measures will put you to sleep as quickly as anything. Here's the thing, though, and you're right, we've been very slow to come to the table. Businesses across the world have used outcome and performance measures almost since the mid-50s. This is something that just became popular within criminal justice in the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. In 1995, in fact, the American Probation and Parole Association, along with the National Institute of Justice, put out what I think was the first article about outcome and performance measures for the probation field.
Mm-hmm.
That was followed by a larger publication looking at outcome and performance measures for the entire criminal justice system at IJJ did. So it's really been since the mid-90s that this whole idea of measuring what you do, especially measuring it against what you have out there as your mission and your goal, has become popular within criminal justice agencies. Pretrial programs, as Laurie mentioned, are just getting into the idea across the country of measuring their performance and knowing what that performance ought to be.
Before the program, we sort of set the stage for this. I when the state of Maryland took over the Baltimore City Jail, was my first real exposure. I mean, as a former police officer, I've been in and out of jails, in and out of booking situations.
Professionally, you mean?
Professionally, yes. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. Spending a lot of time within a jail, wow, what a chaotic setting. You've got thousands of people being arrested. They're moving in the institution. They're moving out of the institution. It's chaotic. It's dangerous. You've got people who are high on some sort of substance. You're processing them. You're booking them. You're making decisions in terms of who to keep and who not to keep. It's a very chaotic, loud, noisy situation. And I sat there as people made decisions based upon instruments as to who they're going to let go on bail, who they're going to let go on pretrial supervision, who they're going to let go on their GPS or home monitoring. And, we're not talking about a business office where it's nice and quiet and sedate. We're talking about a very loud, noisy, chaotic place. And in that very loud, noisy, and chaotic place, we're making decisions that could have an impact not just on public safety, but as to whether or not that person returns for trial.
Mm-hmm. So wonderful point that you bring up, because when we put this document together, and the folks who helped us draft it, or the people who actually did draft it, are the Pretrial Directors Network of NIC, one of the questions that came up is, can you measure performance if you don't have the things in place to make that performance happen?
Right.
For example, if you are screening defendants for release consideration, if you aren't using a validated risk assessment, something that takes into account factors that have been shown by research mm-hmm. to be related mm-hmm. to failure to appear in rearrest, can you really make this measure?
Mm-hmm.
So part of what we are trying to do with the Measuring What Matters document is to say to pretrial programs out there, you have to adopt good business practices. It's not just putting a number and a target out there. It's also saying we need to have in place the things that will make us meet these targets and do a good job. So that validated risk scale that helps you identify who the good risks are, who the bad defendants who need to be incarcerated pretrial are, you have to have those things in place. So that was something that was very much a part of this document.
Laurie, we're going to go over to you for a second in terms of talking about that risk assessment instrument, but amazingly, we're halfway through the program. These programs go by awfully quickly. Spurgeon Kennedy, Director of Research, Analysis, and Development for the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia, is our guest, www.dcpsa.gov. An 88% return rate here in the District of Columbia, one of the highest in the United States. Laurie Yvel, Correctional Program Specialist for the National Institute of Corrections of the U.S. Department of Justice, is our other guest, www.nicic.gov. Okay, so Laurie, we're going to go over to you in terms of talking about instruments. I've been in the system for 42 years. This whole concept of an objective series of measurements has always confused me. It's not my background. It's not my forte. But the bottom line seems to be from the criminological community, from NIC, is that we really can, through objective instruments, objective questions, figure out who's a danger to society, who's not, who's a danger to as to whether or not that person's going to return for trial, who's not going to return for trial. These instruments give us a lot of information about that individual, correct?
That's correct. And it gives us objective information that has a body of research or tested so that we can make statistical probabilities of whether this person will appear in court or their public safety threat, if you will. And, you know, I liked what you had said about jail being this chaotic place in which you're having to make these very difficult decisions around release. And I think one thing that objective, validated risk assessment tools do for people working in jails and pretrial programs is that they serve to provide some objectiveness to sort of corral this chaos so that people are not left to their own subjective thoughts around a person's risk.
Right.
And one of the things that often I think are misunderstood around validated assessments is that we've given all of our discretion to this piece of paper, that this piece of paper, these measures are telling us who's safe and who's not. And I think that what we need to understand is that it is a tool within the overall toolbox to help make good, sound release decisions that are in the public's interest. And again, to make the connection to the document, if we then have local measures and systems set up, we can then see if, in fact, we are making good decisions on release.
Right. Well, just a point of clarification, either one of you can come in on this. We create these instruments, and we do this analysis in this noisy, chaotic, overcrowded place. And then that information is presented to a commissioner, an officer of the court. And he or she uses that recommendation based upon that instrument to decide whether or not that person is released or kept. If the person is kept, generally speaking, in most states, you have 24 hours to present yourself before a judge, and the judge reviews the evidence, reviews the case, and then makes another decision as to whether or not you're kept or released or the conditions of the release. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So it's just not us within the criminological community or us as correctional professionals. It's not us making the decision. Basically, what we're doing is preparing the paperwork for the courts.
Right. We are helping the court make a more informed decision about release and detention.
And in essence, to go back to what we did before measuring what matters from the National Institute of Corrections, www.nicic.gov, you can get the document there, is to basically guess. Is that fair or unfair?
There has always been criteria that courts have used. There have always been criteria that pretrial programs have used. Up until recently, I think you can make the argument, and I would, that those criteria may not have been related to failure to appear and rearrest as much as we tended to believe.
But unless, Laurie would say that unless it's a validated risk assessment instrument, a validated instrument across the board, it's still guessing. Now, guessing may be an unfair term, but in essence, you know, without a validated instrument to guide us, it really is a matter of presumption.
Yeah. We like to call that clinical assessments, but that's still guessing. And what we found, and there's about 60 years of research on this, is that a good validated risk assessment beats clinical judgment about these decisions every time.
Right.
It's beyond a debate now. One of the things that I'll put out there, and there's an organization that would really be helpful for your listeners to know, is the Pretrial Justice Institute.
Okay.
They've put out a couple of publications on the state of the science in pretrial programming. One of them looks at risk assessment and recommendations, and it is really a summary of risk assessment of research that has been done over the last 10, perhaps 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you the common factors that have been coming out of these risk evaluations. It shows you that the risk levels that have been coming out and the factors that predict failure really are becoming common among a lot of jurisdictions. And it's a good read for people who are really interested in what we're finding out about risk.
Well, let's talk about those, because the audience is going to want to know, well, what are the findings? First of all, there are a certain category of people in all probability are going to be kept.
Yes.
You commit murder, you commit rape, you commit domestic violence, you're going to stay in all probability. You're not going to be released on pretrial. You're going to be held in the jail setting. You're going to be held in the jail setting, by the way. Let me clarify jails. Jails are also places to hold people on a pretrial basis. They also are places where people serve short sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Prisons is where they ordinarily serve sentences of a year or more. So
right.
Within that jail, it's just not pretrial people. It's people serving short sentences. So that limits the amount of beds that you have. I wanted to make that clarification.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You also have people, who are also awaiting transfer to prisons.
To prisons.
In jails. And that's becoming a much larger population as state prisons become overcrowded.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because in a lot of states it's a very serious issue. That means 20%, 25%, 30% of your population could be people waiting transfers
exactly.
to state prisons, because state prisons are crowded. Okay, so having said that, what are the other factors? Okay, so they're predictive, and after years of looking at this, we know that they're predictive. What predicts a person returning for trial and not posing a risk to public safety? And I would imagine if he or she has family in the community, owns a home in the community, has a job in the community, that person more than likely is going to return for trial.
Well, community tie information is not as correlated to failure as we believed in the early beginnings of pretrial
right.
programs in the early 1960s, the risk classification tools that were used relied very heavily
mm-hmm.
on what were very middle class
values.
Oh, yes.
If you looked like me and if I was middle class and you were
right.
a good risk to be released,
right.
what we're finding is that a lot of the factors associated with risk are things such as prior failures to appear, substance abuse usage, mental health issues.
Okay, so if you haven't appeared, if you skipped your trial in the past, that indicates you're going to do it again. If you're on drugs when you were arrested and have
there's
drug history, that's their
failure.
Greater chance of not complying.
Yeah.
I think I saw a statistic from Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia that there's a huge difference in the success rate between those on drugs and those
and
not
those
on drugs.
Don't. Right. Those who are non-drug users have much better appearance rates and also safety rates
right.
than those who are drug users.
What are some of the others, either one of you?
Well, actually, your criminal history is one of them.
Okay.
So if you have convictions in the past, that is one of them. The interesting thing you had mentioned about a home, that is another one that is not necessarily a predictor.
That's interesting.
Right. And in fact, some of the local validated assessments have actually taken that out.
That's interesting.
Because they have not shown that it has had a predictive quality to appearance.
That's interesting. What else has a predictive quality? Mm-hmm.
Well, those are the big ones. I think there are about seven or eight that mm-hmm. you see in most of these validated studies. The question for the local jurisdictions are, A, how do you define these factors?
Mm-hmm.
In Washington, D.C., for example, a prior failure to appear might be defined a little differently than other jurisdictions, depending on how you get data from your court. The other is whether or not you weight these criteria the same. A prior failure to appear might be one of the main factors in my jurisdiction. It might be a lesser factor in other jurisdictions. So while we see these factors in most risk validation studies, how they're defined and how they're weighted in the final assessment.
So one size is not going to fit all in terms of a measurement instrument.
Exactly.
The measurement instrument could be looking at the same variables in Kansas City and San Diego and Washington, D.C., but yet be interpreted and applied differently.
Much differently.
Right. Based on local culture, differences in jurisdictions, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So everybody, it's not just one size fits all. Everybody gets to take a look at this and measure. But even with that measurement, there's still a human being that says, I don't like this outcome. I think the person should say, I think the person is a flight risk or a public safety risk. The person can override the instrument,
exactly.
Correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the performance measures in our Measuring What Matters piece, in fact, is how often the pretrial program actually complies with its own risk assessment. We suggest anywhere between a 12 to 15% override rate. If you
right.
find yourself in that range of overrides of a risk assessment, we think you're okay. Because you're right.
Okay.
Risk assessment tools, as great as they are, do not put all defendants in their proper risk places.
Well, I would imagine it's also going to be concerns regarding race, gender, income, and an objective instrument sort of evens everybody out.
Yes.
So if you're suddenly making exceptions for, 30% range for income, you get to ask the question why.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea behind all of this is to generate data and ask questions of yourself as to why you're getting the results you're getting, and are people showing up for trial, and are we protecting public safety? It allows the individual jurisdictions to take a good, hard, long look at themselves and to improve.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And that's
Absolutely.
The bottom line behind what NIC is trying to do across the board in terms of correctional practice, to take a good, hard, long look at yourself and improve.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And, this actually, the document, one of the purposes, I mean, there are many, as we've talked about today, but NIC provides a training, as you said, in Colorado for new pretrial directors. And we found that we had new pretrial directors that were being put into these departments and didn't know really what should they be measuring,
mm-hmm.
what were their guiding principles. And so it's part of what NIC is also doing to help bring on new directors and shaping really how pretrial is functioning across the United States.
Well, we're just about at the 2-minute warning level. Any final thoughts, any quick final thoughts, Spurgeon?
Well, only that I really encourage not only pretrial programs, but also any policymaker or any pretrial or criminal justice practitioner to take a look at this document. It should show you how your pretrial programming should work in your local jurisdictions. It should help you determine what your goals and missions are and how to make sure that you're doing the best job you can in order to ensure public safety and to help the court operate as efficiently as it can.
Laurie, 15 seconds.
I would say go find the document at the NIC website. Contact me. NIC is here to answer any of your questions or help assist your jurisdiction in getting the outcomes that they want.
Thank you to the both of you. Spurgeon Kennedy, Director of Research, Analysis, and Development at the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia, www.dcpsa.gov. Laurie Evel, Correctional Program program specialist for the National Institute of Corrections of the U.S. Department of Justice, www.nicic.gov. www.nicic.gov. The document we've been talking about today is Measuring What Matters, Outcome and Performance Measures for the Pretrial Services Field. Ladies and gentlemen, this is D.C. Public Safety. We appreciate all of the comments that you give us, the letters, the phone calls, the emails. Please contact us. Feel free to contact us with suggestions, programs, program suggestions, criticisms, comments, and you please, everybody, have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.